You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our primary question for episode 25 is, what is human nature? As communicated through Baruch Spinoza's The Ethics from 1677, books 2 through 5. This is a continuation of our discussion from episode 24, which was largely about book 1 of The Ethics, so you should go listen to that first. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer, kicking it from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, rocking it in Austin, Texas.
And this is Wes Allwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
Why is that funny every time?
Is that where I am? Yeah, that's right.
I've been on vacation, so if you're wondering why the Spinoza episodes are so long coming, that's my fault. But we got a lot of activity on the blog. You should check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. Since we entered the God area a little bit, even though that's one of the things, philosophy religion, that I came into this podcast and came into philosophy really finding really boring and not wanting to bother with. Now I feel like, we could read some Augustine. We could read some Paul Tillich is one of the current people that Karen Armstrong likes so much.
Are you really crushing on her?
Except now I've heard her talk, so I know it goes by Karen.
Oh, it's Karen.
So that's what she calls herself. But I've learned from her. She actually narrates her whole book that I've been listening to, and there are way more words that the Brits pronounce differently than I even suspected. I think she's doing it on purpose.
Clearly.
Ratiocination. Things like that.
Really?
Ratiocination.
Yes. Last time we talked about Spinoza's conception of God, which is mostly what book one is about, where God is not a transcendent God. God is immanent. Really, all of nature is God. Everything you look at is God, right? Which sort of follows from the fact that God is everything. God is infinite. So therefore, God is this piece of crap on my shoe and everything else. Some other things that sort of follow from, really the rest of this I characterize as being about human nature. So the mind-body relationship, what that means for how we get knowledge. So he's kind of a typical rationalist. And then he spends a lot of time talking about the passions, the emotions. And once he set that up, then, that sort of gives a picture of human nature. Given that he said that we're all determined, everything we do, everything we see, everything that is a direct emanation and necessary emanation from God's nature. So everything is predetermined. But still, we have this, once you set up this notion of the passions, and by contrast, reason, we ended last time talking about these essences and how we know proofs of geometry and things like that. So once he sets that up, he gives us kind of a formula for living an ethical life, despite the fact that all of our actions are predetermined. It's more of a virtue ethics thing, right? You can't just give us a rule and say, everybody follow this. So there's a psychology built in of, how can you enable somebody to be ethical, given that they're going to be motivated by their passions? And just getting clear about what his meta-ethical views then are, given this thoroughgoing determinism.
All right.
We're starting on the mind and body, right?
Yeah. The very quick summary of it is that he talks about that the order of things is the same as the order of ideas, where you get this isomorphism between these two causally walled-off realms, where for every extended thing, there's a corresponding thought, including, for instance, for a chair, there's a thought corresponding to a chair, but for a human body, there's a very complex set of thoughts corresponding to that, which are also God's thoughts, but which basically constitute our mind. And it's not that there are two types of substances in this case, mind and body. He's a monist in the sense that there's really just one set of things ultimately, but they are conceived of by these two different attributes.
Conceived of by us.
Yeah. Well, and the attributes are also, it gets complicated because those attributes belong to God, right? Extension and thought. It's not merely that we've made them up exactly, but the point is that those two attributes really ultimately belong to this same more fundamental reality, what's substantial, and it is one unified thing. So we get a kind of identity theory with Spinoza, which is, has some similarities to, say, identity theorists today who say the brain is the same as the mind. But one distinction to make here is that for modern identity theorists often talk about one of those two things, brain or mind, being sort of more fundamental. So the brain causes mental states, for instance. Or some people would want to say they're the same, but one's reducible to the other. But the matter is the thing that everything gets reduced to. And then the idealist would say, well, what seems to be material objects really just are mental. For Spinoza, that's not the case, right? The thing that everything really reduces to is at a level below both the material and the mental. It's that unified, whatever substance belongs to God, God dust that underlies the different attributes of extension and thought.
Right. You were commenting last time that he kind of purposefully mixes together the ontological point with the epistemological point. That is, I don't know if you can say, you know, God in himself has these two attributes. Certainly, we don't know if they're the only two attributes. In fact, he says they're...
Well, he says there must be infinite, yeah.
Infinitely many attributes, but these are the ones that we can perceive. I mean, that sounds almost Kantian.
It does, yeah.
That's our way of hooking up with the universe.
Yeah, and you can see why when we talk about these two causal orders, right? He needs to put together cause in the sense that we might think of causality in the hard sciences, say one phenomena causing another, one billiard ball hitting another and causing it to move. But then there's causality in the sense of explanation, where one thing is explained by what causes it. So for any given thing, its essence consists of everything that explains it, where everything that explains it in the one realm of the thinking just is everything that causes it in the realm of the extended. So those two things coincide as well. Because you have this coincidence at some more fundamental level of thought and extension, then you can say that causality in the sense of things knocking up against each other, and causality in the sense of why is this and how do I explain it and giving a definition of things, those two things become the same at some level.
It's an associative view of mind, that an idea leads to another idea, which leads to another idea. But the way they do that is the same, like, as physical causation, right? If you have, you want to understand why this book is there, then you think of what caused it to be there and think of what caused it to be. So the physical run of causality is the same as the way the ideas would run, if you're thinking about it.
Yeah. And the ideas just run on their own little plane, right? They're a completely sufficient little causal realm in of themselves. So if you want to say, I went to the fridge for ice cream, and then say why, and say I'm hungry, you get a little causal realm. You don't make references to what's extended there. You don't say, well, my body caused my mind to be hungry and blah, blah, blah. It's the sequence of ideas that has its own little explanatory causal integrity. And then on the other level, you just describe a machine where the body has certain states, which will, when it reaches a certain homeostatic situation, it's going to tend to do this and blah, blah, blah. And those two things don't jump back and forth in the Cartesian way. They simply remain separate aspects of one more fundamental unified thing.
But which explanation seems to make sense in a given circumstance depends on the motivation involved. And that's going to be very important for his ethics. So if I take a purpose of action because I've reasoned something out, I have a bunch of beliefs and I've determined this is the thing that I must do, then that's a very easy way to give a detailed causal account of that purely on the mental realm. Whereas if I just get an urge and I do something, he's going to say it's easier to give a reasoning for that, I think, on the physical realm, right? In fact, we don't even understand when we have emotions, when we get urges like this. Yeah, there's an idea that's associated with it, but we don't really understand that emotion. We don't necessarily understand why we're having that urge or where it came from.
Well, he says there's an idea for every part of the body, right?
And yes,
when we say there's an idea for chair, we don't just mean, hey, there's an idea in my mind that corresponds to chair, represents chair, even though that's possible. But the chair itself has an idea that hangs around with it in the same way that our mind represents our body. So it's a very panpsychic type of theory, I think, in where the chair has its own mind and that broader sense of mind. And then you could do that for every part of the body. So you could take an organ and say, there's a representation of that organ, even though we're not aware of it.
But if we learn about it, then we become aware of it, right? I mean, that's... So if I'm having a pain because I have a certain problem with my liver or something, then somehow if I can learn about that, if I can become more educated about any, in other works he recommends explicitly, training in physiology and things like this, then, well, it's not that the urge goes away or something, but at least I can see where it comes from. And whereas I might feel it as an emotional affliction, God is torturing me with this pain in my liver. Once right. I have a medical understanding of where that's coming from, not only could I then take moves to physically treat it with some medicine or something, of course, but even if I can't do that, I can separate out that feeling from the emotion yeah. that it might have given rise to in me. And I can then, as a stoic, sort of bear through the pain and put it in perspective or something like that.
Yeah, because the representation itself, right, is just, it's what he calls confused or... And it's confused because whatever's happening in your body, well, I'm thinking now of representations that involve interactions with other bodies. So when we perceive things, so something causes a pain in the liver, that's both a representation of the body, of the liver, and the thing and, that's right. doing it. So it's always this interaction, and that causes a confusion. We're confused about whether we're representing something that's just of the body or the thing that's affecting the body, and what we do when we... science is we help make those distinctions. We help make it clear what belongs to, you know, the thing that's causing and the thing that's being affected.
Yep.
You know, one of the things that I remember that I thought was interesting was there's a part in there where he talks about the idea of self-knowledge, a kind of reference to, I think, Cartesianism, but he talks about the ideas that we have of the body not corresponding to the complete picture, that we can't ever have true self-knowledge or complete self-knowledge because we can't possibly ever understand or have ideas of all of the things that are happening when our body does something very routine. And this is similar to that conversation we had a couple of episodes ago where we talked about your brain says, pick this thing up. It doesn't say, okay, shoulder muscle move this way and then bicep and tricep work together in this way to make this thing happen. Like things happen in our body that we do not consciously comprehend. But on Spinoza's model, there have to be ideas of those things, but those are ideas that we don't know.
They're not hanging around in our intellect.
Yes. Yes. So they're part of the causal chain, but somehow we're not. It's weird. We don't really have a language to use that makes sense, or our typical language that we talk about, self-awareness and consciousness, doesn't really work in this context. You know, you can't say we don't have this idea. We do have this idea. It's part of the causal chain. It's reflective of the attribute being the, you know, an attribute of God. But we as modes of God, one of the aspects of our modality, if you will, is to not be aware of all of the attributes or ideas that make us up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he uses these spatial metaphors that it's like we're localized. In fact, so he defines each of us, says the idea of the individual mind is that of the individual body, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which means, I mean, you can't actually doubt that you have a body for him. Like Descartes right. says, you can doubt that.
Right.
No. But, you know, couple that with Descartes thought that the contents of our mind were all transparent to us. At least it sounds like he thought that sometimes. Whereas clearly for Spinoza, because the idea that our self corresponds to, which is our body itself, is actually made up of a whole lot of parts. And so consequently, the idea of the self is itself made up of more parts than we are conscious of. So we don't even, our minds are not transparent to us because our bodies are not transparent to us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, Descartes did have the clear and distinct versus fuzzy
yes.
idea distinction, but... Because for him, the clearness and distinctness isn't something that you could be deceived about, right? Whereas
right.
Descartes entertains being deceived about it by God.
I looked a little, just over the past couple of days, on the improvement of the understanding, which is like over a decade earlier. And he specifically talks about in there how if it's a simple idea and I can see the whole thing, then it's not something I could be mistaken about. Both in the ethics in his epistemology part and in this, it's really evident that he's been reading the Theaetetus, the Plato reading that we talked about in another episode, because he's really concerned about false belief. How could false belief be possible? And, you know, mm-hmm. given that things that we're completely aware of are all clear and distinct to us, well, it has to be because there are multiple ideas being combined or ideas that we only have a part of or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He uses geometric examples like any rationalist, mathematical examples as key that we completely understand the concept of 1 + 1 or something. And so we can't be wrong about that. But once you get into really crazy complexes of things, it's easy for some part of it to slip our mind and us to be wrong about something.
Mm-hmm. The clearness and distinctness has to do with this thing for Spinoza that all ideas are representative, right? They're all representations.
Perception is around book 2:17. If the human body be affected in a way which involved the nature of any external body, the human mind will contemplate that external body as actually existing or as present. until the human body be affected by an affect which excludes the existence or presence of the external body.
Right.
Just like he says, you know, our bodies are made up of all these pieces. He gives this model of perception and of memory that these physical objects actually affecting parts, you know, bumping into us through eyes, through nerve impulses. You can give more modern language behind it. It bumps into the fluid parts of our body and creates an impression, which is very much like Plato talks about it, or at least one of the things he considered. So here's in the middle of there. When external bodies so determine the fluid parts of the human body that they often strike upon the softer parts, the fluid parts change the plane of the soft parts. And thence it happens that the fluid parts are reflected from the new planes in a direction different from that in which they used to be reflected. It's like individual neurons are being affected in some way, such that if a signal runs through them again, it will be deflected in, you know, in a corresponding way. And that also, afterwards, when they strike against these new planes by their own spontaneous motion, they are reflected in the same way as when they were impelled toward those planes by external bodies. So in other words, we can call up through memory, we can call up perceptions, and it's actually reproducing some of the physical activities that were going on there. Consequently, those fluid bodies produce an affection in the human body while they keep up this reflex motion similar to that produced by the presence of an external body. The mind, therefore, will think as before, that is to say, will again contemplate the external body as present. This will happen as often as the fluid parts of the human body strike against those planes by their own spontaneous motion. So, in fact, the only reason imagination or memory is different from perception is that there's some other perception that gets in the way. So that if I think of my mom right now, well, I'm also seeing this computer monitor in front of me, and clearly, right, unless, you know, my mom is not there. Whereas if I was in a sensory deprivation chamber, he doesn't use that term, of course. I forget how he describes it, but if you get in such a way that you're mad or you're isolated from other things, and these ideas in your head will seem real because there's nothing, right, there's no other ideas that are jumping forth. There's no other perceptions that are jumping, right, forth and contradicting them.
Right. Which goes back to his whole confusion versus adequacy thing. There's always a level of certainty, but it's a matter of degrees. And then those degrees are brought on by the sort of competition of other ideas which overpower them. You know, we talked about that ontology of overpowering being very important.
I don't remember us talking about that.
Well, that's one of his first, right? There's nothing which is simply can't be overpowered. There's always something more powerful that can push it around. And that's important because
that proves God exists in the first place, right? Is a way, one way of doing it.
Yeah. But then it's also, you know, we're going to get to this role that power plays in psychology and all that stuff. But the power here is it's a matter of the ways in which certain ideas, but, you know, as you said, the computer monitor, for instance, exclude other ideas. So it's not like any idea is clear or distinct or in and of itself. It's relational. So that's where the confusion and adequacy thing comes about.
But the way we understand something, according to him, is by understanding its cause.
Right.
Right. The reason we can understand mathematics so well is because it is a very, very short causal chain. The fact that 1 + 1 = 2 proceeds from the essences, you know, of one, which to understand those things, the fact that, you know, number is one of those things that can apply to everything. So it's like a universal concept in Kant's sense. So those are the kind of things which we can know clearly and distinctly because they apply to everything. And they're in fact kind of implicit in our perception of any particular thing. And right, you could say the only thing that's prior to that, that causes that, is God, right? That these are part of the essence of God directly. The same way he says, even though you might think this is strange, if you just pay attention, we have a complete adequate idea of God because that adequate idea is in the same way in everything we perceive, just like number or space or something, because God is the grounding of everything there is to perceive in very concrete ways. Just the fact that this thing I see is in space, well, space is the attribute through which God shows himself, even though it seems like a conceptual leap to say, oh, space is an attribute of this God. I mean, that seems like that's one of the most incredible unique things about his philosophies. He's saying this, but no. He's just saying that's clear and distinct. That's obvious when you think about it. And so God is a simple idea, right? Because when we think of God, we don't have to think of a cause of God. We don't have to follow the causal chain any further. So we can completely understand the idea
of God. Well, God is self-caused, right?
Exactly,
it's important,
exactly.
That, yep, he be self-explanatory. He can't just be a brute,
right,
you know, unexplained thing himself, yeah.
Whereas everything else, you have to follow a causal chain back, and there's a chance of it getting distorted or not understanding where things come from. And certainly the system of nature as a whole is not something we can understand in that way. There's way too much going on.
Mm-hmm.
that's the conflict for people, is that, you know, in one sense, the idea of an individual human, individual body, individual mind, is just a species of the general mind, which is part of the essence of God, right? Just like the essence of space is the essence of God, mind is the essence of God. What could be simpler than our minds? Like, it's just only one step removed from the conception of God. But as things play out, adjacent, you might say, use this spatial metaphor, to the idea of ourself is all these other ideas that are floating around, which correspond to different ways parts of our bodies have been affected. And those are confusing. If you trace the physical causation back, they're going to come from something external, right? That is bringing about my hunger or bringing about my lust or whatever it is. And that's a much harder thing to understand than this simple relationship of mind to God, according to him. I see why you're having trouble with this clear and distinct thing here, because he doesn't spend that much time on it here. He talks about it way at the end. So he has these three kinds of knowledge. So one we've talked about is the knowledge through perception, which is going to give us these weird, inadequate ideas because, you know, it's something has bumped into part of us and left an impression on us. And so what we understand, some of that's from us, from our soft tissues. Some of that's from the thing itself. And of course, even just the fact that it bumped into us doesn't mean we understand its whole nature. It's just that one part of it bumped into us. So we really have an inadequate idea of what that thing was. Mm-hmm. And then the second type is understanding the clear and distinct ideas through reasoning, like analyzing geometry. The third type is this intuitive science, which he doesn't get into till the very end of the book. And that has to do with understanding how things are grounded in God. And the more we have of this intuitive science knowledge, the more joy we get, the more we understand our relationship to God, you know, and that's really the point of virtue. Right. Again, I'm not understanding completely here the difference between the second type of knowledge, this understanding of clear and distinct ideas that you were talking to, and the third type of knowledge. If anything, I'm liable to try to combine them. I guess you can have knowledge through reason, you know, knowledge of mathematics without necessarily reflecting on the relationship to God. So what makes it intuitive science is you add this third component that you're hooking it up to God.
Yeah, the intellectual intuition of the essence of things under the aspect of eternity. That's the third kind.
Okay, so what's the second kind?
That's just scientific knowledge of the causes of things, right? The first kind is just brute perception. The second kind is scientific knowledge where you generalize. And then the third kind is the intuitive knowledge. So the second kind is a knowledge of causes and things like that. What we would think of as science and maybe philosophy, I guess. Right?
I'm not remembering the second one as that. I thought it was something more to do with reason than to do with empirical science. And granted, he might just have not had the same notion of empirical science as we do, that these guys, when they thought about science, it was something that is grounded deductively.
Well, no, I mean, the empirical sciences are doing well at this point. It's
Right, but the model of empirical science, like that Newton had, is not that, you know, we make these inductive generalizations from individual experiments. It's, no, we can come up with these universal laws by observation, yes, but it's observation plus reason that lets us come up with these universal laws. So that's the notion of science he has. It's not a strictly empirical discipline.
I don't think we would say it's strictly empirical. Right.
Right.
You're coming up with models to explain appearances. Those are often abstract models.
Sure. Right. But current philosophy of science would say these models are not just, you know, given by, you know, they're more, oh, they're paradigms, and you can have different kinds of paradigms to represent things. They're, you know, theoretical infrastructure that we build. Whereas for the, at this point, the idea of science, which was very positivistic, is that this is the way of representing things. You can have a clear and distinct idea of the of gravity or something in the same way that you can of math. Am I misrepresenting that? I haven't read my Newton recently, but I think that's...
I don't know. The Principia Mathematica, he invents calculus basically in it, but it's written in the manner of Euclid's Elements. They're all geometrical proofs.
Yeah.
It's not like he said, you know, we've observed the inverse square law. He doesn't do that until as late as possible, right? He wants to do as much a priori as he can. And then he does thought experiments where he shows that nothing but an inverse square law would work. Like if with an inverse cube law, everything just spirals in. But still, you know, the scientific revolution is mm-hmm. full strength. But I don't know. That's a complicated question of...
They've not made the hard distinction in the way Kant does between reason and experience.
Right. That's true.
Mark, I'm sorry. I'm misunderstanding here.
Are you saying that Spinoza says there's three kinds of knowledge?
Yeah.
I thought there were only two, inadequate and adequate.
No, I mean, those are two levels of clearness and distinctness. But the three types of knowledge are just the chaotic, brute perception, and then what I'm calling scientific knowledge, or I think rationality is in there too, but it's also scientific empirical knowledge that's ordered and made universal and made causal. And then the third kind would be this intuitive grasping of essences, which is kind of hard to figure out what that is exactly.
So it's in book two, proposition 40. Those ideas are also adequate, which follow in the mind from ideas which are adequate in it, which just says deduction works. But it's in the Scholia 2. From what has been already said, it clearly appears that we perceive many things and form universal ideas from individual things represented by the senses to us in a mutilated and confused manner without order to the intellect. So the numbering here is confusing because he numbers them 1, 2, 3, but actually 1 and 2 are the first kind. So the first kind, which is the inadequate knowledge you were talking about, Seth, is knowledge of from individual things represented by the senses to us in a mutilated and confused manner without order to the intellect. These perceptions I have therefore been in the habit of calling knowledge from vague experience. Number two, which is actually, this is also still the first kind of knowledge, from signs. As for example, when we hear or read certain words, we recollect things and form certain ideas of them, through which ideas we imagine things. These two ways of looking at things I shall hereafter call knowledge of the first kind, opinion or imagination.
Oh, I see.
All right, here's the second one, which is number three here. From our possessing common notions and adequate ideas of the properties of things. This I shall call reason and knowledge of the second kind. And he doesn't give any examples to this here. He refers us back to proposition 38 and 40. Right, 38 is about those things which are common to everything, which are equally in the part and in the whole, can only be adequately conceived. So that's why I was talking about notions like space and number being adequately conceived. And then 40 is the one we're reading now. Those ideas follow in the mind from ideas which are adequate in it. So it's really these things of pure reason is the second kind. It's not things of science.
Wait, no, I don't follow that.
Actually, I shouldn't say that. I should put in all the provisos that we were just discussing regarding Newton. You're saying, from our possessing common notions and adequate ideas of the properties of things. So yes, those could be space. Those could be geometry,
yeah,
the things that Kant would
right.
point to. But it could also be gravity, right? If everything in space is subject to gravity,
right.
if everything in space is subject to the physical laws, to inertia, those are also things that we can have adequate ideas of.
Yeah, I mean, where else would you put science? I mean,
yeah, but you'd have to use information from the senses to actually see an individual instance of gravity being enacted, right? I drop this thing. Well, maybe I really didn't drop that thing and I'm just mistaken about my perception of it. So that's really
right.
knowledge of the first kind, but it's the generalization from that, which he's not going to say a general, right? It's not a generalization. It's not induction. It's top down. It's that we can intuit.
I don't know if we can say whether or not he's saying this is induction or not induction, because if you want a Kantian parallel, you look at one as Kant's manifold, fragmentarily, uh-huh. confusedly, without order through our senses, and two is where I would think we get both the intuition, the ordering in space and time, and the understanding. So you get all of that stuff, and then three is what Kant would call reason. That's the parallel that I would make.
Clearly, everything in this book, I think, you know, it's, except maybe the God stuff, but most of this book would be the second kind of knowledge, right? That's why he's doing this pseudo geometry, which is obviously empirical at the same time. When he's talking about in the relationship between the different emotions, he's ordering our perception in a certain way. So that's still knowledge of the second kind.
You're right. I think basically Kant gets rid of three, right? He says there's no intellectual intuition. And so what's combined in the second kind for Spinoza will get divided up and for Kant, and then he'll get rid of Spinoza's third kind. So yeah, that's the rough correlation.
Here's the quote that he has here on the third kind. He says, besides these two kinds of knowledge, there's a third, as I shall hereafter show, which we shall call intuitive science. Is that what your translation says? Probably not.
No, I don't think so.
What is it?
He just calls it intuition.
Okay.
Intuition.
And Kant goes on and on about this intellectual intuition, which he repudiates. So.
Yes.
This is one of the authors he's thinking about.
This kind of knowing advances from an adequate idea of the formal essence of certain attributes of God to the adequate knowledge of the essence of things. All this I will explain by one example. Let there be three numbers given through which it is required to discover a fourth, which shall be to the third as the second is to the first. A merchant does not hesitate to multiply the second and third together and divide the product by the first, either because he has not yet forgotten the things which he has heard without any demonstration from his schoolmaster, or because he's seen the truth of the rule with more simple numbers, or because of From the 19th proposition, the 7th book of Euclid, he understands the common property of all proportionals. But with the simple numbers, there's no need of all this. If the numbers 1, 2, and 3, for instance, be given, everyone can see that the 4th propositional is 6 much more clearly than by any demonstration, because from the ratio...
Oh, wait. No, I think I'm right.
...in which we see by one intuition that the first stands to the second, we conclude the 4th.
So the tradesman, the first thing we just have is habit, right? He just knows how to do something by
the
habit.
The schoolmaster told him. Yes, that's the first kind of knowledge. It's inadequate.
So it's not really, doesn't really know why. He just knows how to do it. And then
the second kind, because he's seen the truth of the rule with the more simple numbers. So in other words, he uses reason.
Wait, is that the second then?
That's the second kind right here.
No. The way my translation has it, he can do it either because he's gotten it from the master or... because he's made trial of it with the simple numbers. I was wondering if the paragraph that comes after is the third one. You know what I'm saying?
What the simplest numbers.
Yeah, because that's where he talks about intuitive grasping.
Yeah, you're probably right. I think you're right.
No, but I'm unsure. I'm not. I think this is ambiguous. I think...
All right, well, we don't fully understand. We understand that he makes the difference between, you know, inadequate and adequate, like Seth was saying. But I think in the key to this third kind, as he says, he's going to defend later, because certainly this example does not get clear, is seeing intuitively the relationship of the thing to God.
Yeah, so that was my first reading.
Right. Whereas the second kind is all the rest of it. It includes both science.
Math.
Science at a high level, Newtonian, coming up with the basic laws of nature science, and math.
And probably philosophy as well. I don't know.
Yes. Yeah, you're right.
Don't know that philosophy would qualify as the third kind, since it's got to be intuitive grasping, which means not discursive, not simply reasoning through, not deducing, just getting it in one eidetic whole.
Right. So that's going to be kind of the key, that once you can see your relationship, see that you as a mind are a subsection or a mode, I should say, of the mind of God, then that he's awesome. It's, you know, it's a mystical experience. He doesn't say that. You can live with your blessedness with this permanently on your mind, or more or less, right? If you're dedicated enough and good enough at mastering your emotions, and you can keep this insight clearly in mind, this intuitive insight. All right. So we got, I think the next big point was this one, that will and intellect are the same. There's no free will. So you can't have a notion of, oh, well, in any given idea that I look at, I can decide whether I believe it in it or not. I can, like Descartes does, I can just doubt all this. I can say, let's just pretend, I don't believe in my body right now. That's not the way. We don't have the freedom over our beliefs like that. If we intuit something that's true, we believe it. So built into ideas themselves, he thinks, is the affirmation of our will to accept it, right? Any adequate idea, we will have to accept. We will see that is true. We can't doubt it.
Yeah, assent is built in the representation, right?
The way he says that in the mind, there's no volition or affirmation and negation, accepting that which the idea, insofar as it is an idea, involves.
Yeah, and so willing something is just a representation too, right?
Right.
There's no free will in that, what I think of as a everyday man on the street sense. We have determinism where our willing something just means that that's a way that we're representing it to ourselves.
Yeah, and he characterizes this in a number of places as desire.
Right.
Not necessarily meaning the base desires from the base emotions. Like, all will is something we just encounter in ourselves. It's there. It's desire. And if we come across an instance where we have, oh, I have this desire. I really want this woman, but I also don't want to want this woman. I know she's married to somebody else. Well, that's not a case of me having a desire and my willing not to follow it. It's a case of having two desires that are conflicting.
Right, right. And one overpowers the other.
Right. And yes, you can say actually one comes from a baser source than the other. And so if you want to talk a little sloppily, then you can say, you know, I'm choosing not to follow it. I'm following my reason against this desire. But really, that's all that needs to be qualified. He doesn't mean that in the ordinary sense. Everything breaks down to individual unfree desires.
Everything mental is representative for Spinoza. It's not like there's joy or pain on top of a representation. Sadness just will be a representation of our decrease in power to act.
Right. And to think.
Yeah. And it's not an awareness of the decrease in power plus this emotion that we kind of usually think of as just being added on, the affect. The affect is the representation.
Right. And just one comment, we kind of skipped over the physics section. I don't want to go back to it really, but he talks about desire as really the same as inertia. So that,
right.
In fact, since all bodies are the same substance, they're all God, the only reason they're the way they're distinguished, it's kind of an atomistic view, is via whether they're in rest or in motion. So the one property that he thinks individualizes all these little things. And of course, you know, macroscopic things are lots of little packages moving together. And in fact, that's how he defines a physical object, is that you have all these, we could say atoms, but he doesn't use that, that move in concert. So if I pick up the baseball, then it stays together as a baseball, and that's what makes it a physical baseball, you know, why we consider it that way. We can talk about our own desires, and really every perception that it's in us, every idea in us tries to persist, right? We were saying, I'll even keep thinking of my mother unless some other idea or perception comes in and wipes that away. And that's what desires are. They all have this inertia. It's the thing, whatever it is, trying to continue itself.
Right. But that's, strictly speaking, the striving.
Yes. I'm not sure what you're distinguishing that from.
Book 3, Proposition 9. The mind has its striving and the body has its striving. Taken together, they're defined as appetite. Then, appetite together with consciousness of appetite is what he calls desire.
All right.
So this is how it reads in the Yule's translation. The mind, both insofar as it has clear and distinct ideas and also insofar as it has confused ideas, endeavors to persist in its being for an indefinite period, and of this endeavor it is conscious. That is a really, really difficult sentence. But he says, and note, this endeavor, when referred solely to the mind, is called will, and when referred to the mind and the body in conjunction is called appetite. It is, in fact, nothing else but man's essence.
Which is interesting, because a lot of this is trying to banish final causes, right? That you don't have, like Aristotle says, things in nature trying to get to a certain goal. You don't have earth tries to go down. You don't have any of that kind of stuff. But yet everything tries to persist in itself. He has that little bit of it still there. That's not goal-directed. That's just persist. In any case, the essence of us is desire. And these individual, each of these ideas within us, even if they're inadequately given, which are what the passions are pumped by this inertia. And we've already talked about how psychology is associative. Just like Hume, if you've seen two things in conjunction, and then you see one, you're going to think of the other. And so right. That's how a lot of emotions seemingly are built up, that we've got this basic desire, and he talks about, it's really based on pleasure and pain here, right? It sounds very much like Bentham. His whole ethics, even though it gets to this being one with God and stuff like this, he's following Hobbes here. Right, that we are like mechanically bounced around between pain and pleasure, right? That pleasure is something we will go toward, pain is something we will go away from. That is really our whole motivation. It's just that because our minds and bodies are made up of so many individual parts, therefore they can have different desires that push in different ways. And so we can be pleasurable in one respect and painful in another respect or something. And so those things, you know, the same thing, if it's affecting multiple parts of our body, can give us pain and pleasure, and things get complicated this way. And then association is the other key to it. So he says love is just pleasure associated with the idea of something causing that pleasure.
I mean, what's important here is the concept of power, right? And whatever increases our power, when we're conscious of that, we have joy. And when we're conscious of the opposite, we have sadness. And then in Proposition 11, that's what helps explain pain and pleasure.
Right. So pleasure is associated with this built up of power, and pain is associated with the lessening of power, which sort of makes sense. I'm in pain. I hurt my foot, so I can't go out and do what I want to do. I can't think about what I want to think about because I have this pain in my foot or my toothache or whatever. It's a matter of how it makes us act. If anything increases, diminishes, helps, or limits our body's power of action, the idea of that thing increases, diminishes, helps, or limits our mind's power of thought. Therefore, the next one, 12, the mind endeavors as much as possible to imagine those things which increase or assist the body's power of acting.
That's a sort of extension of the striving to persist, right? Because we can't anticipate all the things we'll need to survive. And power just builds up our quiver to deal with all the possible things that could take us out.
But it's just funny that he immediately makes this jump to, we like to imagine, we like to think about the things that build us up, and we want to not think about those things that knock us down, which put that way doesn't sound correct. And so he has to give, you know, in a very long roundabout way, an explanation of how people do seem to pursue and dwell upon what hurts them or what hurts others, which is another jump. But let's go through these kind of quickly, because otherwise we'll never get the basic theory down. Because we have all the pieces now. We have this, we go toward things that build us up. We go away from things that tear us down. That's what joy and sorrow really are connected with. We have this associative model of mind. And so we like to not only just imagine things that make us happy, we like to get those near us. We like to dwell on them. And so that's what desire for a particular thing is, right? I perceive that reading Spinoza makes me so happy. So it makes me want to carry my Spinoza book wherever I go. And then he talks about the next big chunk of it are more about the mind's relative reaction to things past and future, and or necessary and contingent, or imagined or not imagined. You know, if we remember something that made us happy, or if we fear something or expect something that's coming up that we imagine, you know, will make us happy, then we're gonna go toward it. So 19 here, he who imagines that what he loves is destroyed will sorrow. But if he imagines that if it is preserved, he will rejoice. So it just, once we have connected pleasure or pain or building us up or knocking us down with some external object, then that's what loving or hating that external object amounts to. And everything builds on that. So if someone else loves a thing you love, then you're going to love that person. If someone is similar to you, then you're going to think of yourself when you think of them. And so if they love something, then you'll love it too. If somebody does something to harm something that you love, then you're going to hate that person, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't think we need to go through all of
them. I want to give the general idea that this is supposed to really build us up to just about any reaction we have to things.
And it all comes back to this representation of power to act.
Yep. We endeavor to bring into existence everything which we imagine conduces to joy, and to remove or destroy everything opposed to it, or which we imagine conduces to sorrow. We shall endeavor to do everything which we imagine men will look upon with joy, and on the contrary, we shall be averse to doing anything which we imagine men are averse. We're making the move here to not just being passively pleased or displeased by things, but to the social. And again, some of that is the fact that if something is similar to us and can have desires, you know, we will have pity for someone we can identify with that is having trouble. We don't have pity for someone who is fundamentally different from us, he thinks. So even, you know, insofar as we have pity for suffering animals, it's only because they're sort of similar to us.
Right. Pity is a kind of imitation. That's why.
Yep.
My sadness at someone else's sadness is an imitation of their sadness, which is right in a way, right?
You know, yeah.
Let's talk about empathy.
There's a lot in here that reminds me of Nietzsche, just the way you're talking about the will to power. And Nietzsche is very down on pity. And it's hard for me sometimes to figure out reading Nietzsche why that is the case. But here Spinoza is spelling it out. It's because you're seeing someone else who is sad, you're imitating that sadness, you're bringing sadness upon yourself, and that's bad, by definition.
Okay.
Well, if we're letting somebody else drag us down, that's bad. I mean, it's better than the alternative, it's better than being completely cut off from other people. But I'm jumping ahead to the actual ethics, talking about better in here. But the way better is built out of, in the later section, is straight from these built-in desires and tendencies that we have. So, I mean, ethics is going to be a human creation based on some sort of generalizations about these fundamental ways that we are manipulated by our environment, which is basically the same way that Nietzsche grounds it, right? We have these built-in will to power, and so what we value will grow out of that, or at least it should, he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same way, there's enough complexity here of different parts of ourselves, and now we're involving different people, that things can get confusing. And I mean, it sounds like these are all actually things that would help us. Like if we were talking about a creator that designed us, if we were allowed ourselves to talk about final causes, which he doesn't. But he does, in some places in here, Spinoza criticizes people that say, oh, you know, there are parts of human nature that are bad, or they're badly constructed, or there are parts of nature in general that are poorly constructed. He says that, no, if you look at all this, it actually makes a lot of sense that this faculty of desire and our faculties of emotion, our own suffering, are in fact a way of keeping us alive, or a way of pushing us toward this will to power, which maximizes, he doesn't use will to power, but which maximizes our ability to function and maximizes our health physically and mentally. I mean, it's interesting that he draws such a correlation there, and maybe this goes back to what we were talking about that this is not induction. It's not that he's just observed this a couple times, or at least he thinks he can use the observations to point at a universal law, right? Because the mind and body are in fact one and the same thing seen through distant aspects, then of course the health of the body is going to be equivalent to the health of the mind. And if you have a situation where that seems to diverge, like, I've been exercising so much that I never read a book and, you know, I'm so strong. Well, then he has to talk about, oh, well, there's some part of the body that's not being used to its greatest potential or something like that. It's never the mind versus the body. It's different parts of the mind versus each other and different parts of the body versus each other.
Right.
And those acting in parallel. So I guess where the bad stuff comes in, I see the first place is on Proposition 32. If we imagine that a person enjoys a thing which only one can possess, we do all we can to prevent his possessing it.
Yep.
If we imagine that a person enjoys a thing, there will be sufficient reason for making us love the thing and desiring to enjoy it. But, by hypothesis, we imagine that his enjoyment of the thing is an obstacle to our joy, and therefore, we endeavor to prevent his possessing it. So most of the time, if we like something, we want other people to like it. If other people like something, we want to like it too. We want to really spread the joy around. And ultimately, this is what's going to be the reasonable, the moral action for Spinoza. But in practice, because there's limited resources and we think if somebody's being an obstacle to us, then we're going to want to bring them down. Just like if there's something that I love and somebody destroys it, then I'm going to hate that person. Well, it's the same thing here. If there's something that that person has that they love, therefore I will love it, but only they can have it, then they're preventing me, so I will envy that person.
This is the one I reference where he says in the note, or probably in your translation, Scolium, man's nature is generally so constituted that he takes pity on those who fare ill, and envies those who fare well with an amount of hatred proportioned to his own love for the goods in their possession. So it's the same thing, the love for the goods in their possession, which leads to both. You can go either go down the pity track or the envy and hatred track.
Yep. And then the next bunch of propositions are, you know, some very insightful, but we don't need to necessarily go into the details here, right? If we love a thing which is like ourselves, we want to make it love us in return, right? And what follows from that? All this jealousy. If I love somebody who doesn't love me back, then I will turn and hate them more than I ever would if, you know, I didn't love them in the first place, or if they cheat on me, whatever. Let's skip to the next important point. 61. If we imagine that we are beloved by a person, without having given any cause for the love, we shall love him in return. The one right before that says, if we imagine we are hated by another without having given him any cause for it, we shall hate him in return. So hate breeds hate. But hey, if you can conquer hate with love, if someone is mean to you and you love them anyway and they perceive that, well, then they'll probably love you. At least there's a chance of that. And that's, again, going to be key to his whole ethics. Overcome hate with love. Hatred, which is altogether overcome by love, passes into love, and the love is therefore greater than if hatred had not preceded it. Really?
Yeah.
So it's like the love-hate relationships on the various sitcoms and things, where they hate each other, but suddenly, here's another chink in man's evil here. It's 67. The joy which arises from our imagining what we hate has been destroyed or has been injured, which he says we have, that is not unaccompanied with some sorrow. So even this whole revenge, and we like to destroy things that we hate, if we actually destroy something, there's some sorrow there as well.
Just the important thing is how these are all propositionally built up out of those few, you know, out of, again, that tendency to increase power thing, and then it all cascades from there.
Okay.
It's really amazing the way he goes from so little to describing all the affects, which I think we might not be inclined to see as so reducible to this tendency to increase power, you know?
Yeah. And then he talks about our attitude towards ourself, right?
Yeah, where's that?
When you're 53 is where it starts. When the mind contemplates itself and its own power of acting, it rejoices. And it rejoices in proportion to the distinctness with which it imagines itself and its power of action.
Right.
When the mind imagines its own weakness, it necessarily sorrows. And then he goes to talk about pride coming from that versus self-esteem, you might say, the good kind.
It seems like we're struggling. He has this principle of unity, this unity where we're all part of this larger whole. And there's some kind of principle of harmony or concordance that he's just spelling out in part three. If two desires are conflicting, there's kind of this disharmony and it causes issues. Where two desires are in concordance with each other, there's no conflict. That this is really going to be the basis of his ethical system. We use the term pleasure and pain, but that's really just a description of the outcome of whether or not your actions accord with all of these other things that are modes of God, there's essentially this underwriting principle, and I don't know if it's explicitly spelled out, that God strives towards some sort of harmony, or nature strives towards some sort of harmony. So insofar as your existence is harmonious, which somehow just means not in conflict or not discordant with others, then you're doing the right thing. And insofar as it becomes discordant, then you are doing the wrong thing.
I don't know if I would want to say that the system of nature is pushing toward harmony. Like, that sounds too much like it's goal-directed behavior. I mean, the whole thing, all this apparent disharmony is all, you know, the nature of God. So it all is underlyingly harmonious. Before, in talking about the problem of evil, we were saying last time that that's just us imposing our aesthetics, you might say, on nature. It looks like things are all crashing into each other and there's all this chaos. That's because we're using these man-made conceptions and trying to apply it to the whole, trying to judge things by it. And there's just no room for that. These notions of good or evil come out of our own desires. And so we can use those notions to try to live in such a way that we put ourselves in harmony with other things, which is really comes down to, just like we were saying, that you have a clear and distinct idea, that, or at least the most clear and distinct ideas are simple, right? That where you understand, you've got all the pieces in front of you, and you can see exactly how they hook up, like basic, simple mathematics. Well, in the same way, if you can act such that you don't have to, in explaining your own behavior, you can just refer to your own essence. There's a simplicity to that. And so then that's the way you clearly and distinctly understand yourself. You understand the essence of yourself. You are simple in the same way that, you know, these mathematical things are simple. And there's somehow that makes you closer to God. I'm not comfortable with the whole way he puts God in here, because on the one hand, he's saying everything is God. But on the other hand, he's saying, but some things are more godly than others. Or something like that. That is, if you are acting according to your own nature and not letting yourselves be pulled about by all these different affections that are really external things exhibiting their will on you, then that's going to be beatific. To say that those things are good, it means that's ultimately what we're shooting for. It's not to say that there's a good side of the universe and there's a bad side of the universe and we need to line up with the good side or something. It's not Platonic like that. It's just a matter of things, making things subjectively work out for us.
I thought by the end of part three, you know, we would have the ethical system that underlied this. But really, part three is just a way for him to basically create the metaphysics of emotions.
Well, it's human nature, right? He's elaborating human nature with emotions being...
But he's elaborating human nature, but in the context of his metaphysics. Because ultimately, he's going to then use the human nature to talk about right and wrong action, but it all has to roll back up to the metaphysical system, right?
Well, but right and wrong action are human constructions. Right and wrong are human constructions built upon this fact of nature that we get pleasure and pain out of, you know, increasing or decreasing our power and all these things he's talking about in this section. So there's nothing normative yet in this whole part three. That is all the explicit ethical language is added, like in part four, somewhere in there. I think we've finished part three. At the end of most of these, it's nice that he gives a kind of summary. Like, I've been building these up geometrically, but now I'm just going to lay out. So, you know, here's all my definitions of all the passions in this case. Then even with the other parts, you know, he talks about, you know, sort of lays out the ethical system in a more straightforward way. We might be better off looking at that rather than slogging through the proofs. Though that's useful as well to see what his reasoning is here. Because otherwise it just sounds like a watered-down Kantianism or something like that, or Platonism. He definitely seems like a guy who was very familiar with Plato and Aristotle on ethics and trying to, you know, just like Plato thinks we always go toward the good, virtue is its own reward. We've got a similar thing going on here. He doesn't want it to be like we're pursuing an abstract form of the good or something like that. It's all on an individual, concrete level. I have this desire. If I was rational about this desire, then I would pursue it in such a way that I don't favor one part of me over another part, that I'm a well-balanced individual, that I keep my relations good with other people.
You know, maybe just want to get into the good and
let's do that.
Bad as he defines it early in the book four. As for the terms good and bad, they indicate no positive quality in things regarded in themselves, but are merely modes of thinking or notions which we form from the comparison of things one with another.
Yep.
That's one and the same thing can be at the same time good, bad, and indifferent. So, in what follows, I shall mean by good that which we certainly know to be a means of approaching more nearly to the type of human nature which we have set before ourselves. By bad, that by which we certainly know to be a hindrance to approaching the said type. So he's given us human nature, he's given us the psychology in the previous section and how that stuff works, and now he's going to get good and bad out of it.
It's interesting that he uses a model here because, you know, like I was saying, in other places he explicitly says he's not an Aristotelian, that there's this, you know, ideal of virtue and that we all must get ourselves into that. But here it almost sounds like that. I guess the fact that it's not externally imposed, I don't know if it is for Aristotle either, though. It's that we can look at our own reactions and what we really want underlyingly, and from that come up with a model of how we should act.
So there's an essence, right? And there's, I mean, it's how individual it is up for debate, right? So you would have a human nature and then you might have a marked nature. But how, regardless of how you take it, you know, he talks about this type. What you're doing when you're striving to become more powerful or to have a greater capacity for action is to go from the power of action insofar as this is understood by its nature. So in a way, it's not just any kind of power that's being increased, right? To say something is increasing its power for the sake of self-preservation, well, there's a certain type that's being preserved. There's a certain essence, and some things are going to go against it and tend to diminish it, and some things are going to tend to increase it, and that's where we get, where we can derive good and bad. But it's unclear if we're speaking just about human nature in general or whether we could drill down and say, you know, mark essence or something like that.
Right. Well, a little earlier, one of the last 67 in the previous section, he says, the affect of one person differs from the corresponding affect of another as much as the essence of one person differs from that of the other.
Yeah.
So in other words, you know, just like we were saying, what an affect is something external interacting with me, but I have so many parts to me and, you know, I'm going to have a certain uniqueness about me because of the relation of all my parts as compared to you. And so even though he's giving these psychological generalizations and he thinks we can talk about individual virtues and individual emotions using these general terms, they're still all going to be a little different. So my way then of pursuing virtue isn't going to be exactly the same as yours, even though, yes, we
I think it's complicated because he does elsewhere talk about essence of human beings in general. So I think probably the best way to conceive of it is that you can have more general or more specific essences, that you could say human nature in general, and then you could say mark essence or mark nature, and then talk about how those things can be increased or diminished. So there are going to be certain general features, right, that are healthy for both of us, obviously. You know, eating Big Macs isn't going to be good for me and bad for you, even though I wish that were the case.
But he clearly doesn't like the way that this Aristotelian notion of virtue has been used in the past. He gives an analogy somewhere, maybe this is in another work I looked at of his, of, you know, you might look at a house and say, that is a crappy house. That is, there's no way that that's perfect or that's done. But maybe that's exactly the way the architect wanted it. It's that each of us has this individual essence, that that's what we go toward. In fact, the notion of perfection means the same for him as accomplishment. Like, it's finished, right? It is perfected. In other words, it's all done. It's not necessarily perfection like goodness and evil.
Well, it doesn't, right. He says it in this.
Okay, that's in here.
But it's not something we reach. Yeah, the house thing gives us a good analogy for it.
So it's the state of completing ourselves and sort of actualizing our individual potential, whatever that is. I mean, there's certainly going to be an essence of human being insofar as we are mind. We are all modes of mind, which are, again, one step from the mind of God. And so
he just gave us all the common features of our psychology and how we work. I mean, there's a general common feature to humanity.
So this part four is just how he's already talked about the affects. Now it's of human bondage or the strength of the affects. You know, so he's talking about the difference between acting from our own personal nature and acting from nature in general, right? Where we're part of the system of nature and things are affecting us. We can't simply say, oh, you have to be free of your desires, your affects, and act out your essence, because the only way a desire is going to be countermanded is by another stronger desire. And he specifically sets it up that if we're talking about which desires come truly from us, that express our individual essence, that is limited by the strength of the human being, whereas he thinks these strong emotions that hit us are only limited by the power of outside forces. So if a big guy comes and knocks me over the head with a hammer, There's no way that I can just overcome that pain that that giant hammer is inflicting on my head that, that's giving rise to in me. I know I'm being sloppy mixing the physical and mental talk here, but there's no way I can overcome that with just my own will. Or it would certainly take a lot of more willpower than I could possibly come up with to do that. And it does make you think of there's Buddhist strains here, like that he was familiar with the wisdom of the East, or at least fans of the wisdom of the East are also fans of Spinoza. I mean, we already talked about his panpsychism, you know, that God is in everything, the mind is in everything, as being very similar to certain New Agey views, at least. I won't attribute them to actual Buddhism or Shintoism, but Americans pretending to like these things. And in the same way, we have this trying to purify yourself. And, you know, Buddhism says life is desire and we are afflicted with desire. We must get rid of desire because that desire is just suffering, and sort of be independent and exert ourselves. And again, if you remember Nietzsche's objection to Buddhism or something like that, is that no, you can't retreat inside yourself. You can't just shut off the world. You need to embrace it and push yourself out. And there's nothing in the description of a Buddhist just meditating to free his mind from the world that sounds like you're exerting yourself. If anything, your self is disappearing into the larger self or something like that. I don't know. In Spinoza, I guess I kind of see both, because on the one hand, he wants you to have this sort of inner peace where you are one with God. But on the other hand, it sounds like this acting out yourself sounds Nietzschean. And certainly the emphasis on joy, like you shouldn't be renunciating things. You should be packing as much joy of as much variety into your life as you can. There's nothing renouncing of the world in that.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, as you mentioned before, there's a virtue ethics here, right? He, in the definitions, definition 8, by virtue and power, I mean the same thing. And then, you know, again, going back to the preface, when he talks about good, good is what is useful as a means to increasing our power of action, to express our human nature. He says human nature, but, you know, as Mark pointed out, it could be our individual natures. And that is what constitutes our virtues. Mm-hmm. Those powers as they've been developed. And then thinking back to our Aristotle episode, if magnanimity, what did I have to pick the hard one?
Magnanimity.
magnanimity is an expression of our nature in some way, then it's a virtue. And what's good out there, what I should seek, are the things that are useful to increasing my power to express that virtue, or increasing that virtue insofar as it's a power to do things that,
right,
you know, that express it. There's a lot of things pointing towards Nietzsche there too.
Yeah. So proposition 20 in section 4 here, the more each person strives and is able to seek his own profit, that is to say, to preserve his being, the more virtue does he possess. On the other hand, insofar as each person neglects his own profit, that is to say, neglects to preserve his own being, he is impotent. So this sounds almost like Ayn Rand, right?
You're I was about to say, Mark, are you reason. Sure you don't want to read Ayn Rand? You've been concentrating on the virtue of selfishness.
Well, of course, it's because Ayn Rand is stealing from Nietzsche and things like that.
Yeah, and Spinoza, it is a very egotistical sounding. Yeah.
This translation sounds a little bit different. That doesn't make it sound quite so... quite so
use the word profit.
No, it says, the more every man endeavors and is able to seek out what is useful to him... Mm-hmm. In other words, to preserve his own being, the more he is endowed with virtue. On the contrary, in proportion as a man neglects to seek what is useful to him, that is, to preserve his own uh-huh. being, he is wanting in power. I think that phrasing does a better job of tying it back to what we talked about earlier in terms of the will and desire in the context of the preservation of being. So it's not so much just aggregating stuff and getting things. If you neglect your self-preservation, you are lacking in virtue.
Yeah.
Yeah. And remember, good equals useful. That's definition 1 of the section. Uh-huh. So he's going to use useful and good interchangeably. And again, the preface, useful for increasing one's power, blah, blah, blah.
But then where he would part ways with the objectivist is is that there's nothing more useful to people than other like-minded people, right? They're going to be the ones that are going to be working with other people, will help us get what we want, give us what we need in terms of us loving them, us loving what they love, them loving us. Like so many of the affects he described are bound up in that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But it follows from that, that we only really have moral responsibilities toward people that we can have these kind of associations with.
Is that true? You think he thinks that?
Well, he talks about animals.
What does he say about animals?
This is in 37 in the Note or Scholia. Well, the difference also between true virtue and impotence may, from what has already been said, be easily seen to be this: that true virtue consists in living according to the guidance of reason alone. That impotence, therefore, consists in this alone, that a man allows himself to be led by things which are outside himself, and by them to be determined to such actions as the common constitution of external things demands, and not to such as his own nature considers in itself alone demands. Blah, blah, blah. From them, we see that the law against killing animals is based upon an empty superstition and womanish tenderness rather than upon sound reason. A proper regard, indeed, to one's own profit teaches us to unite in friendship with men and not with brutes, nor with things whose nature is different from human nature. It teaches us, too, that the same right which they have over us, we have over them. Indeed, since this right of any person is limited by his virtue or power, men possess a far greater right over brutes than brutes possess over men. I by no means deny that brutes feel, but I do deny that on this account it is unlawful for us to consult our own profit by using them for our own pleasure and treating them as is most convenient for us. So you can have sex with animals if you want. Inasmuch as they do not agree in nature with us and their affects are different from our own. There you go. That's very Kantian.
You know, does this mean we can gratuitously use animals? I'm not sure.
No, but he ends that same section by saying, it remains for me to explain what I mean by just and unjust, sin and merit. And in the earlier part of that same section, he says, whatsoever we desire and do, whereof we are the cause insofar as we possess the idea of God, I set down to religion. He's basically talking about acting according to reason versus acting according to things like pity or fear or faith or those sorts of things. Being guided by emotion, whether that emotion is awe, womanish pity, super vain, vain superstition, or whatever.
Sorry, you thought Spinoza wasn't an asshole? Sorry, here he is.
Well,
womanish pity.
All right, well, come on.
I mean, this you'd
believe the same thing if you lived in.
Yeah, this thing about animals really is just sort of a side note that's intended to explain the general point, which is that we should be acting according to reason, which is nothing new in the history of philosophy.
But we're still looking towards the virtue thing. They're derived from our nature, and that nature involves all those emotions that he's described. So the way I would put it, whether Spinoza puts it this way or not, we, insofar as our obligations to other people are derived from, you know, what we share with them as far as all those emotions and wanting them to be happy, mm-hmm. and this and that. Insofar as animals are similar to us in that way, I think you could say we derive obligations that way. You know, it would seem to me that it would be a matter of degree, right? So there are certain capacities for emotions in animals, much like some of the ones that he describes in the previous section. And to that extent, I could see a neo-Spinoza and differing with Spinoza and trying to spell out Peter Singer style something based on Spinoza's ideas.
Right, well, a utilitarian is a neo-Spinozian in a way, and also a Kantian seems like a neo-Spinozian. You can trace both of them straight back to here, it seems.
I'm not so sure about utilitarianism, because that's talking about, you know, even no matter how broadly you define pleasure, you know, I saw a lot of inconsistencies between utilitarianism and, say, virtue ethics. I think they're different approaches, right? Because the virtue ethics is concentrating more on the individual. And yes, you can, utilitarianism, you can relate the individual and the good of the greatest number, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, that was always a kind of a gap in utilitarianism, that when we read the Bentham back then, it had this calculus of pleasure and pain for the individual, which looked somewhat like what's going on here, in that you could talk about, you know, not just individual immediate pleasures, you could overrule those with sort of longer term pleasures and sort of being rational, applying a calculus. The reason that you need to do that is because, like the things that Spinoza points out, you know, affects relating to something immediately present are going to be stronger than affects related to something in the future. So even, you know, we're likely to give up an uncertain good in the future for a certain much lesser good or something, you know, just because it's right there. Whereas we should be rational and pay attention to what's really in our interest. This brings to mind one of the guys I worked with at University of Michigan, one of the professors I worked under, Peter Railton, had this view of ethics is what is good for me is what I would choose if I had all the relevant facts. You know, there's definitely something in there that's kind of like Spinoza saying, be rational. That's what he means by that. If you really understood how all these other people could help you, how great it will be if you are in harmony with them as opposed to fighting with them, if you really understood that, then you would act in a caring, loving way and maximize all these things. And I see the link from that to utilitarianism. It's only a short leap from saying other people are the most useful things to us, and therefore, just as we should take a long-range view of our own happiness, we should therefore bring other people into the picture too.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you treat as more fundamental in the explanation, right? I don't know. Insofar as I associate utilitarianism with the, you know, the greatest happiness for the overall,
sure.
You know,
no, it never moves beyond that.
Greatest number, whatever, like something like that. Then I can see where some differences with, say, Nietzsche and Aristotle and Spinoza would crop up with the virtue ethics.
And then Kantianism, we might as well talk about that. He's got some very specific things like you should never lie, just like Kant says. And, you know, if you're going to choose to do something, it should be something that you would choose for everybody to do. I mean, he pretty much stated the categorical imperative somewhere in here. And also says kind of stern things like Kant does that, you know, it's okay to even have the death penalty as long as you're not doing it out of, like, revenge. If the magistrate is killing someone out of love for the people, then that's okay. He says that in here somewhere.
Killing in the name of love?
Yes. A desire which springs from reason can never be in excess. So far as the conception of an object is formed by the mind according to the dictate of reason, the mind is equally affected, whether the idea be that of something future, past, or present. Right, so it's all about balancing things for yourself and keeping the past and future in perspective. And that's what really having adequate knowledge is, again.
Yeah.
He's taking this back to his rationalism.
This conversation you guys bring up about utilitarianism makes me think about the same problems I had. Look, I love Spinoza, and I love the fact that he's basically the first and maybe the only philosopher who says, I'm going to not only create a space to talk about human nature that involves emotions and all that, and not be talking about they're the enemies of reason or anything like that. In fact, he spends, you know, an immense amount of time making it very clear how these are all natural and, you know, it's part of our mode of being part of God is to have all of these emotions and to act in these ways and have desire mm-hmm. and regret and all that. But ultimately, he comes back to this idea of, but really, what you want to be doing is acting according to reason. So it's okay to have emotions. You just need those emotions to be overruled by reason, which means having adequate ideas of things, which means having all of this information or having all of this a priori information that you need in order to be able to make these judgments about the way you should act or about the way the world is or about the way what, you know, the way what's right. And it was the same. We had the same question, which is why the utilitarians got angry with us, which was questioning about whether or not this was a legitimate way to talk about a guide to moral action in the sense of could anybody actually in practice put all this stuff together in order to be able to make any judgments or do anything? Mm-hmm. Is Spinoza's requirement so stringent that it would be impossible to follow? Part of the virtue of virtue ethics is that you emulate virtuous people and you start to become a virtuous person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't require a theoretical apparatus. It just requires identifying right. virtuous action.
And I'm never asking myself, well, the social question of the community. I'm just saying this is what increases my power to express my nature, and this is what doesn't. This constitutes my virtue, and this doesn't. I mean, it seems to me a different way of approaching ethics.
You know, we would have to look at his Tractatus Politicus that he wrote part of before he died, after the ethics, to really see how he thinks that you should run a state, whether you need to do these sort of calculations that take in the whole. I think the way that he conquers this for the individual is that, again, you really need to just think about what you really want. And that's going to be harmony with other people. It's going to be the kind of person that he thinks you, you know, to dwell on the positive and all this kind of stuff, to be at peace and have joy. It sounds good in the abstract, but I mean, he really thinks that, so you need to dwell, again, you need to dwell on the positive. A man thinks of nothing less than of death, and his wisdom is not a meditation upon death, but of life. I mean, I can see like, yeah, okay, don't spend your time thinking about bad things that could happen or ragging on other people. He says another place, you know, dwell on people's virtues, not on their vices, you know, because this will make you think more about virtue and make you be more virtuous. But, the Nietzschean part of me says, no, there's more to our desires than that. There's something in us that likes suffering or inflicting suffering on others or, you know, again, mosquitoes. Just as for Rousseau, my current experience with mosquitoes belies all this. I hate the mosquitoes. I don't think I should just become stoic and bear the mosquitoes. I take joy in killing them. I just can't see that as fundamentally wrong.
You have no obligations to the mosquitoes, man.
But still, I should be dwelling on the positive. I should just think of those. Those are just a force of nature. Really, does it matter? Does it make me a horrible person in any sense that I let myself get fired up by this battle with mosquitoes? Like, Nietzsche would be all for
okay,
that.
Okay, well, that's the difference, yeah. He's not saying don't kill the mosquitoes, but yeah, he's saying
don't be uptight about it. Don't get gleeful about the pain you're inflicting.
And you actually get gleeful about that?
Got the fucker. Yes, of course. That's wild. Of course.
Interesting. I just like torturing kittens. But anyway.
So, number fifth part, human liberty.
Part five, of the power of the understanding or of human freedom.
So even though he says that there is no freedom for real because we're all determined, still, just like good is a human intervention. So freedom is a human invention that we can use to reflect on our own, on ourselves and our... and other folks, and how well we can resist our emotions and exert our true nature to be reasonable. And it talks about strategies to not get so mad at the world, right? If you understand that everything is necessary, that everything happens, comes out of God's, then you're not going to be blaming so much. Blame is bad. I mean, this sounds very Nietzschean. Don't get so guilty in the same way. There's no purpose for guilt. He says if we conceive someone's action as coming entirely from them, from a single cause, then we really focus on that single cause and we will react to that. But if we really realize that, oh, well, his action has a cause outside of himself, which has in turn another cause, you know, going on and on, then that spreads out our anger over all those many things and we won't be as pissed off about individual things. So I should not make the mosquito into an agent and be mad at it. Or when my computer is acting up, I should not make it into an agent and swear at it.
It's a very Buddhist way of... dare I say a Zen way of looking at the world.
Yes. And what did you guys think of this end part here? Was it gratuitous? Was it trying to stuff in some Judeo-Christianity where up to now he had pretty naturalistic interpretation of God and all this?
Yeah, I mean, this goes to what we were discussing on the blog. Can you go from this sort of abstract God and the naturalism, God is nature thing, to some sort of sentiment towards God that we could call religious, right? So he's, for Spinoza, it's not a personal God. He's not intervening with miracles, but he loves us and we should love him.
Let's give a couple individual things from here. So 17, God is free from passions, nor is he affected with any affect of joy or sorrow, which follows from what we've, you know, the conception of God that's been to this point. Everything is necessary. He's not affected by things outside of himself. That's what affects are. So he doesn't have affects.
Well, also, he can't go from all the affects have to do with increases or decreases.
In perfection, yep.
Power. Right. So he can't do that. But he can still feel love.
Well, it says he neither loves nor hates anyone is the last. Properly speaking, God loves no one and hates no one. For God
is an intellectual love,
any affect of joy or sorrow. And consequently, he neither loves nor hates anyone.
God loves himself with an infinite intellectual love. Proposition
35. Right, right. Okay. So that's strictly speaking, he cannot love or hate anyone. But he has this roundabout way of saying, well, because we can love him and we participate in his being by being minds, therefore he can love us in that he is active within us loving himself. Is that right?
Right. I mean, our thoughts, right? Every human mind is a collection of not just our thoughts, but of God's thoughts. It's a, I would say, a subset of that attribute of God. So,
and then the rest of it is about life after death. Although after is not a word we should use. We already said the mind is equal to the body. There are different points of view on the same substance, the same chunk of God. So it seems like once the body's gone, the mind has to be gone. By definition, you can't have life after death. You can't have immortality of the soul in the way that a Christian or whatever wants you to have. However, while you can't have life after death, there is a certain way in which, like you were talking about essences. We were talking about, so there's an essence of the human body. There's an essence of the human mind that participates in God, and these essences are atemporal. So insofar as we are godly, insofar as we are expressing our own essence as a mind and a body, and not acting as a part of nature with other things exerting their will and their power upon us, then we are acting according to this universal, timeless essence. you could say, well, after your body dies, after you die, well, insofar as while you were alive, you had in common with God that atemporal essence, then, well, that still exists because it's atemporal. So, I mean, that sounds to me a little like, you know, you will merge with the cosmic oneness. Like, because you're right. Already the cosmic oneness, and you can realize at any time, and the oneness that you are will always be there, even if your individual body dies. It's pretty abstract. It sounds like he's trying to be consoling, but I think the more you think about it, it would not be consoling for an actual Christian who wants to have life after death. It's a Platonic kind of immortality, right? The form of you is still there. The form of... just not you, the individual, with all your imperfections and drives. In fact, because drives all come from the body, then by definition, the part that is eternal can't have affects at all.
We're talking about 23, by the way, right?
Yeah. It goes on in the next ones to talk about that third kind of knowledge, the intuitive science or intuition, which is knowledge of God. The more we understand individual objects, the more we understand God. The highest effort of the mind and its highest virtue is to understand things by this, the third kind of knowledge. The third kind of knowledge proceeds from an adequate idea of certain attributes of God to an adequate knowledge of the essence of things. And the more we understand things in this matter, the more we understand God. And therefore, the highest virtue of the mind, that is to say, the power or the nature of mind, or its highest effort is to understand things by this third kind of knowledge.
I think you're right that the third kind is science. An adequate idea of certain attributes of God, meaning thought and extension.
Yeah.
So we proceed from that adequate idea to the adequate knowledge of the essence of things.
Yep, yep.
So I think this is the one that's, this is where the science
is. If we can trace causality all the way back to God.
Well, also to study nature is to study God.
Sure.
You know,
right.
To be a scientist is to be a
theologian.
That is a form of communion with God, yeah.
Wow.
I like it.
And he talks about this understanding things under the form of eternity or subspecies aeternatus. Is that right?
Aeternatus.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's, I think, often the phrase that is attributed to Spinoza and used. You know, so that's the intellectual love of God. And then you were saying, okay, 35, God loves himself with an infinite intellectual love. God is absolutely infinite. That is to say, the nature of God delights in infinite perfection accompanied by the idea of himself. That is to say, with the idea of himself as a cause, as this is what we have called intellectual love.
God is the ultimate narcissist.
The intellectual love of the mind towards God is the very love with which he loves himself, not insofar as he's infinite, but insofar as he can be manifested through the essence of the human mind considered under the form of eternity. That's hard. That is to say, the intellectual love of the mind toward God is part of the infinite love with which God loves himself. So again, just that spelling out a little further. Yeah, strictly speaking, God doesn't have any loves at all. But insofar as God is our minds, and our minds can dwell upon ourselves from the point of view of eternity, dwell upon our own essences, then yes, God can love through us himself. So that's about the end of the book. What do you think? What did we miss? I mean, I love this as a complete, aesthetically satisfying system. But if I actually try to be critical about it, about the individual components and do I like what this ethics wants us to do? Well, some of it I think just seriously psychologically misrepresents us. There's so much insight in a lot of the individual things he says about jealousy and the way our loves and hates move. But then I read the Freud or think about other things. Spinoza is ultimately saying that the human psyche works, that we are capable of sustained happiness, that we can be in harmony with all things. And Nietzsche and Freud just straight up deny that.
Well, I mean, I think you could say, though, then, because the idea of virtue, right, becomes the idea of health and sickness, right? That's what it turns into, ultimately, with Nietzsche and Freud.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being virtuous or unvirtuous really is more about health and sickness than anything.
And not about having clear and distinct ideas. You could have lies that are helpful to you.
Yeah, but I mean, for Spinoza, too, I think it's about health and sickness to some extent. And so, yeah, whether or not you think that there can be this sustained happiness. You can certainly think that there's better or worse, mm-hmm. right? You can think that there's healthier or unhealthier. I mean, and Freud brings up the possibility, right, that there may be a as good as it gets that still inherently involves some conflict. So to be healthier in one sense may mean to be sicker in another, and you're just kind of screwed. Human nature is inherently conflicted and screwed.
Right. For Spinoza, you get that really passions are always going to be clearly have the possibility to overwhelm. You know, the outside world is so much more powerful than we are as individuals. So, yeah, it's going to be a long, hard road.
Yeah, and what you do, of course, your task is to engage with those eternal things, including philosophy and science, I think, and probably art as well. Sublimation in general, which I personally like that idea of that being the solution. But you engage with those things, and to that extent, you're most powerful, you're most expressive of your nature. And whoever possesses a body capable of the greatest number of activities possesses a mind whereof the greatest part is eternal. So he associates that increase in power with becoming eternal. And then, you know, and then there's that Stoic element to this, which is that the more the mind understands things about the second and third kind of knowledge, it is less subject to those emotions which are evil and stands in less fear of death. So the idea is that, yeah, instead of living a life where you're sort of buffeted by external calls to pleasure and self-indulgence, you're, you know, I guess, engaged in these projects which have that, what I call, sublimating aspect to them. And to that extent, you always have something that you're engaged with that in a way is under your control. You know, because otherwise, you know, you wouldn't have that consolation, right? You'd be completely engaged in the ups and downs of having this pleasure and not having this pleasure. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're saying that porn empowers us to take our pleasure into our own hands. And, that's what you're saying.
Well, you could say, no, and this, again, it does go back to Freud. There's fantasy, you know, there's such a thing as fantasy. And, you know, it's necessary part of human nature, but it can be very unproductive when it takes over. It can be very unhealthy. But it depends. So when you're an artist or when you're a scientist or when you're sublimating, doing constructive things, you're taking fantasy, which could be, in its sicker form, simply running away from reality, which I think is what you're getting at. Just trying to bury your head in the sand. And instead of doing that, it's taking the harshness of reality and doing something constructive with it. It becomes something that's beautiful and made aesthetic, even though it's, you know, something that in and of itself might be painful or ugly to us. And I think that's important.
Right. Spinoza should talk more about art and catharsis and things like that, because it just sounds too much like, ooh, that's all bad vibes. Get away from that. You need to be serene. Whereas I think there's...
Yeah, that does. And that, you're right. I agree with you on the Stoic part of it, which is, you might think, really isn't consistent with virtue ethics, right? You might think, I mean, in Aristotle or in Nietzsche, right, who's very against asceticism and, you know, their Stoicism is in saying, you know, I'm going to detach. I'm not going to love anything in the world because it can be taken away. And then there's Stoicism where that's sort of what Spinoza seems to be doing, where you love things and you love people, but when they are taken away, you understand things at such a level that it's less disturbing, let's say.
But kind of what I'm struck by is the fact that at one point it seemed like you were able to find echoes of pretty much all of the major figures post Spinoza in something he was saying. And, you know, in the first podcast, we had spent some time talking about how he essentially radicalized, this is, you know, invented this idea of immanence, at least in a kind of modern form, the God is nature, and, you know, had this tremendous impact. We've kind of like always known that Spinoza is a philosopher's philosopher. You know, he's the one that's always referred to by other philosophers as, you know, you have to read this guy, or you're either a Spinozist or you're not a philosopher, I think, is something that Hegel said, something like that. Why is it that he's not considered sort of more part of the mainstream and kind of a bigger name sort of outside of the community? Why do you think it is that everybody is, I don't want to say everyone, but people know Kant, they know Descartes, but Spinoza doesn't factor into that?
I should say that I think I only had to read like one short article or something for an actual class. I don't even know what it was. I read some on my own, but that was pretty much it for most classes.
Well, he's undergoing a big revival now, though, right? With the philosophy of mind and his monism, because of those, you know, so you have people like Damasio. Are you familiar with his stuff?
No.
So he's a behavioral neuroscientist who's written some books incorporating Spinoza. One of them is Looking for Spinoza, Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. And, you know, right now is sort of like the big Spinoza revival.
It's a fantastic undertaking, And it's obviously a phenomenal intellect. And the ethics is a work of sort of incomparable structure. And you think about what it would take to actually think through all of this and put this all together. And he kind of finishes it through, sees it through, right? It gets a little wacky at the end, but it's not like Kant and Heidegger, who end up doing a lot of work in like footnotes and sort of losing the thread in the second half of their gigantic works. He was fascinating, and this is definitely an amazing, amazing work. I can't help but think that it's either like the most important thing ever written, or somehow it's just like just off topic enough on so many things to just be complete lunacy.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of individual components here that even though they fit so well together in his system, that certainly are separable. And you might want to, you like the God idea, but, you know, not find his, the details of his ethics particularly in line, or the other way around. That I had read Bob Solomon's The Passions, and we're probably going to do that an episode on that at some point. And his big point in that is that the traditional contrast between reason and the emotions is oversimplistic and misguided. And I feel like he got that to some extent from Spinoza. Spinoza, even though ultimately, yes, for ethics, you come down, there's good emotions and bad emotions. The destructive ones and the peaceful ones that are more reasonable. But ultimately, every emotion has rationality at its core. It's like shooting for something. It's not just blind rage or something. There's a logic to the emotions such that you could put them on a chart that you have, you know, object is contiguous to me, plus it has offended somebody I love, therefore I hate it, you know, that you can build them. And that's just the way that Solomon talks about it. And that was considered such a, you know, a breakthrough work, and that the emotions are an area that's usually been neglected in a lot of philosophy. And so it was neat to see so much on that in here.
Mm-hmm. Not too long ago, I listened to one of the Philosophy Bites episodes. It was an older one, but it was about Spinoza's recognition of the importance of human emotion. Yeah, he recognizes the critical part that they play, and he even creates a space in his ontology for it. But ultimately, they're going to get trumped by reason. So we're just back to Plato. I think Solomon was trying to do something different. I haven't read that book, but I heard him speak before, and I think he was trying to say that there was something more essential to human nature about the role of emotions, and that we shouldn't be trumping them with reason all the time. Am I mistaken in that?
It's that emotions all have some sort of, he differentiates emotions from feelings, right? A feeling, like the feeling of pain versus the emotion of disgust. And even though we use the word feeling and emotion as synonyms, and I see that exact same thing in appetite versus desire, or whatever. I'm not sure exactly which the distinction is, but, you know, pain and then hatred is pain plus a cause. So it's like there's this primal pain there, which is in some way unanalyzable or something. But then there's also this declarative sentence connected to it. It's that this thing is causing my pain. And so how do you fight? How do you not be disgusted or feel hatred? Well, you can still feel the pain, but you got to change the judgment that's involved. You got to say, oh, it's not. And that's exactly what Solomon is talking about. Well, this is a fun one. I'm glad we got all the way through it and didn't need three episodes to do that. I don't know if people would put up with that. I feel like this was a test of our acumen, that we've gone through the basic, you know, a few people's ethics in abstraction, a few people's epistemology in abstraction. We haven't talked much about metaphysics, but here is a, you know, a whole integrated system that you got to work through from beginning to end. And we haven't had that in our reading since Wittgenstein's Tractatus, which is so piss poor in its details, you know, about the ethics in the later parts of it compared to the length and repetition and interconnections that are involved in this Spinoza reading. Mm-hmm. So next time, Sigmund Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents. Look at partiallyexaminedlife.com. You can sign up to have emails sent to you of new topics and other postings to our blog. You can have things sent to you via Twitter. You can have discussions with us. You can recommend what we should talk about next. There's an ongoing topic on our Facebook page about that. You can join in discussion, look for videos related to this episode and other topics. Buy a t-shirt, partiallyexaminedlife.com. Good night, everybody. Thanks for doing this again.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
It was 7:45. I was feeling quite alive as I finished up the note I wrote for you. But as I scribbled out your name, I was feeling just the same as when I nearly lost my mind, as I will do. 'Cause when I think of you, I feel I'm glowing. And when I see your eyes, I start to see. And when I think of you, I feel like dying, or being someone not so much like me. It was 7:54 as I closed the mailbox door and went back to my room to get some sleep. But all I did was close my eyes and think, or maybe fantasize, of all in you that touches me so deep. 'Cause when I think of you, I feel I'm glowing. And when I see your eyes, I start to see. And when I think of you, I feel like dying, or being someone not so much like me. Pain drives me on, but I'm still breathing, managing to keep some self-control. And until I pass on, I'll keep believing there's something in you that'll make me whole. My life has gone to seed. I just sit around and read. I just sit and stare and do not turn the page. It's a teenage kind of race, but you know that's what you face when you're dealing with a man who acts his age. 'Cause when I think of you, I feel I'm glowing. And when I see your eyes, I start to see. 'Cause when I think of you, I feel like dying, or being someone not so much like me. Pain drives me on, but I'm still breathing and managing to keep some self-control. And until I pass on, I'll keep believing there's something in you that'll make me whole. I feel a rush of air, it's like I'm flying, collecting all the pieces of my soul. And until I pass on, I'll keep believing there's something in you that'll make me whole.